WGN on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Okay, those credit card statements will be coming out soon for what you did in December. And some of you might be a little afraid to peek at what you did in that month. You're not alone. Matt Schultz joining us now, Chief Credit Analyst from LendingTree, LendingTree.com. And Matt, a lot of Americans, you know, as much as we say don't take on the debt of the holiday season, we do it anyways, don't we?
We sure do. A lot of people did it in 2024. Our survey found that 36% of Americans took on some sort of debt this holiday season. And maybe the most troubling thing of it all is that only about 44% of those folks actually planned to. So a lot of people are coming into the new year with debt that they didn't think they were going to have.
We just want to define this. When we say take on debt, you mean they put gifts or money or food, or excuse me, on the credit card, but they are not going to pay it off on that statement.
That's correct. Yeah. And what we found is that there's an awful lot of people who are going to take 5 months or more, or even just making minimum payments on this debt. And it's one thing to take on a month or two of debt. That may not be that deal. But when you're talking about 6 months or longer, then that's stuff that really matters and has a big impact on your goals.
For those that went into debt over December, is that debt deeper than previous years, or are we getting that shaved down a bit?
It's a little deeper than it was a year ago, but it's a little less than we had seen in some years prior. So the average is $1,181, and in the previous year it was a little over $1,000. But in previous years to that, we had seen it anywhere from $1,200 to about $1,500. So we're a little worse than we were last year, but not quite as bad as we have been in some prior years.
What's behind this? Just traditions of what the season is? Trump people's fiscal, I don't want to say responsibility, because this happens to people, and a lot of times it's unexpected expenses, but the holiday tradition does not move out of the way for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's for sure. And some of it's just simply inflation. If you just bought the same things this year that you did last year, you were going to end up paying more money for it. So that means that a lot of people ended up having to either cut back or make some difficult choices. But then also some of it may have been that people, after a challenging, stressful year for a lot of people, sometimes people in the holidays are just like, you know, I'm going to blow it out and kind of make up for a difficult time. I think there was some of that too.
Right. There's a little, I'll worry about it later. Well, later is here. Knock, knock, knock. Is
sure.
Taking on debt exclusive to people of lower incomes, or is this a problem that is experienced across all sorts of the areas of the wealth spectrum?
Oh, no, there's absolutely an issue with debt across all income levels. A lot of people are surprised to learn that high-income folks take on debt, too, but it absolutely is the case. In fact, our survey showed that 38% of people who make $100,000 a year or more took on holiday debt, compared to only 30% of those who make less than $30,000 a year. So it's not just about income.
Well, Notorious B.I.G. said, more money, more problems. So, yeah, that happens on the holidays as well. Do we regret it? I mean, is there a sense of come January we'll see the damage that this caused? Maybe we hold on to this debt for months. We take $1,100 and we end up spending, when you accrue the interest, up to $1,600 more than that. Who knows what it ends up being, depending on how long you take it. Is this a regret we have, or do we just kind of shrug it off and do it again next year?
Honestly, it's probably a little of both, but we found that about 40% of folks said that they regretted spending as much as they did, and about 60% of folks said that they are stressed about having taken on that debt. Having said that, doesn't mean that they won't end up doing the same thing next year, because their financial situation may be similar. And honestly, who on earth knows what's going to happen in 2025 with the economy, with inflation, with the new administration? there's just so many X factors going in that it makes for a difficult time for folks.
Yeah. Any thoughts for people that are sitting to this conversation and going, well, yeah, I did take on a little bit more debt and maybe feeling a little overwhelmed by the tenor of our conversation?
Do what you can to get your interest rates under control. Something like a 0% balance transfer card can be really useful. A low interest personal loan can be really useful. But you can even call your card issuer and ask them for a lower interest rate. LendingTree did a survey early last year that found that 3 out of every 4 people who asked for a lower interest rate on a card in the past year got one. That's a big deal.
All right. We appreciate that. Great conversation, Matt Schultz. Take care, okay?
You too. Thank you.
Chief Credit Analyst at LendingTree. Bree Fowler joins us from CNET, senior writer. Bree, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
And it's a Happy New Year for Tesla, huh, as we look back in the fourth quarter. Jeez.
Well, yes and no. They have reported their sales for the quarter, and they were up 2.3%.
Okay.
But you look at it compared to last year for the year overall, and it was their first year-over-year sales decline since at least 2015. And analysts are worried about slowing demand in the U.S. and elsewhere for electronic vehicles overall.
And why are they worried about that generally? Is this a industry-wide issue that the people who wanted one got one, and now they are struggling to find more people that need it or can afford one?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much all the people out there in the U.S., at least, that wanted one of these has got it. A lot of people still remain on the fence because of range anxiety, worries about charging infrastructure, things like that. And, you know, these are still pretty expensive vehicles, even though Tesla, because they've needed to jumpstart demand, has cut pricing in recent years.
Tesla, you would think, then would want to look to other markets maybe that haven't been tapped. But I imagine they give more competition in areas where Chinese EVs can actually sell, right?
Right. And Chinese EVs are considerably cheaper. There's also competition from U.S. and European automakers as well. They haven't quite got the market share that Tesla does right now, but, you know, it's not their entire business either.
How's their stock price reacting to this? Only because I've seen it's gone up considerably, especially since the election of the former and next president.
Right. Tesla stock overall since the election is up about 50%, looking at the last 12 months, actually. But it took a dip on the news. So, you know, if you're kind of that kind of investor, you might look at this as a buying opportunity, a chance to get in at a discount. But the sales don't bode well for Tesla's fourth quarter earnings, which will be coming out at the end of the month.
I imagine the connection between Elon Musk and President Trump on a personal level and a campaign level helps that surge. Is the thought being that future President Trump in his next term would continue to not allow Chinese EVs to be sold here, in a sense protecting Tesla's market more so than other presidents may have done?
That's one of the things. Also, that maybe he would dial back on tax incentives and, you know, basically the measures that are out there now to allow competition to get in to kind of get other companies to sell electronic vehicles. Tesla is already entrenched in the market, but the other automakers, they need to get their EV production going, and they're dependent on things like tax breaks and incentives from the government to actually make that happen.
So the fact that the previous or the current administration incentivizes other American companies to create EVs through rebates and such, Elon Musk doesn't want that. He wants control of the market. I see.
Right, definitely. And, you know, we're talking about American automakers like General Motors, Ford, companies like that. You know, they've really kind of shrunken their production in the U.S. The idea was to get more electronic vehicle production here and, you know, keep those plants that formerly, you know, powered the economies of the Midwest and other places to keep them going in the future.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of the president-elect, he's gone to the Supreme Court essentially saying, hey, don't allow this sale or disbarment of TikTok, which is supposed to take place on January 19th. This seems to go against some earlier, I mean, he originally wanted TikTok banned 4 years ago, right? I don't want to call it a flip-flop. It might be an evolution of viewpoints that we've seen here over the past 4 years.
Yeah, TikTok is definitely the big tech story of the beginning of the year. TikTok and lawyers for the government will be in front of the Supreme Court very shortly doing their oral arguments in the case. The government wants to ban TikTok. There was a law passed by Congress this year and signed by President Biden that would basically eventually lead to a ban of TikTok if ByteDance, the Chinese parent company that owns it, doesn't sell it to a buyer that the U.S. deems fit. Trump, you know, he had previously called for a TikTok ban back during his first term. Now he's saying, well, you know, this is actually kind of useful to me. He used it during his campaign. He says he wants to save TikTok. He's not said how he's going to do that. The brief that his lawyers filed in this case is just to, it doesn't really take sides, but what it asks for is a stay of the ban until they can come up with some kind of political solution to it. He doesn't say what that could be, but he wants to handle it himself.
I mean, the clock is ticking on this, though, right? Like, I mean, the Supreme Court's going to hear it. Are they going to do, like, an issue, a ruling, or is this something they have to wait till June to figure out, but by then it's too late? I'm kind of curious in how the judicial movings of this happen.
Yeah, the Supreme Court is very mysterious in how it operates. They also have the option of issuing their own stay, just kind of putting things on ice until they issue a ruling later. Oral arguments are set for January 10th. The ban is set to go into effect on the 19th, and inauguration day is January 20th. So we got a lot coming up in the next week or two.
All right. I'm fascinated by AI. I love certain aspects of it. I know there's a lot of fear out there, and maybe some justifiably so, maybe some over the top. The one thing I do fear is that our government has no idea how to handle any of this and how to regulate it. And I look at what New York is doing under Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, and I'm glad they're kind of addressing things, but what is it exactly that New York now is doing with their AI rules?
So lots of states have actually kind of gotten in on AI regulation, California in particular. And it's more of an effort to keep tabs on where AI is being used and how it's being used. Because the thing is, we just don't really know how AI works a lot of the time. And there are a lot of concerns out there about discrimination, bias, things like that. What New York is trying to do here is they passed a bill recently that requires state agencies to perform assessments of any software that uses algorithms, computational models, or AI techniques, and then submit reviews to the governor's office and legislative leaders and post them online so the general public can see them too. You know, it's an effort to give transparency and also, you know, prevent AI from making critical decisions that really should be done by people, like who should get childcare assistance or unemployment benefits.
Yeah, it's a hard one, though, because AI can do certain things more efficiently and cheaper, and that could be good for government spending. Of course, AI could run amok and go out of control, but we also, as a country, we want to be a hub for AI development, and overregulation of certain industries could slow that down. This is not as easy as ban it or slow it down or make sure we know everything. I mean, it's a complicated issue, Bree.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, no one wants to see AI go away, but, you know, this is a double-edged sword here that we really have to be careful with and at least know what we're doing.
Is AI like one of the major stories that you're kind of covering and looking forward to see this evolution here in 2025?
Yeah, definitely. AI is on everyone's bingo card this year, and it has been the last couple years, but I think more and more you're going to see it used in, you know, practical situations and getting more involved in, you know, the creation of things and just how software works, you know, even if you don't see it firsthand.
We talk about the rapidity of change and how the adaptation or people adopting new technologies is speeding up. I don't forget where I was reading it. Maybe it was CNET.com. The idea that we adopted, you know, radio at a certain speed, TV, we adopted it a little quicker, the computer a little quicker, the phone, boy, we quickened, meaning the time from when the product came out to when we all used it, that time shrunk. And that AI has also done that, that more people are using AI quicker than they did the phone or the computer, which spells I think, a story of AI exploding, although there's this limit to how much it can pull from and how much server space it needs. I mean, there are some potential speed bumps on the horizon.
Yeah, definitely. And with any kind of ramp up in production of anything, you have to deal with supply and energy and sustainability and dealing with eco-friendly issues with AI, because there is so much processing and so much power involved in doing all this. You know, people are worried about utility prices going up for the average American, and, you know, having enough capacity and power to just keep this going as demand for AI services keeps skyrocketing.
Absolutely. And you'll be covering it all at CNET.com. Bree Fowler, good to chat with you, okay?
Happy to be with you.
Absolutely. It's the Winter's Business Lunch. I'm John Hanson in for John Williams today. I'm thrilled to chat about the Zestimate. This is what Zillow puts out what your home is worth. And it's a really interesting discussion of whether it should be used, how it's used, and whether it's all bunk or not. And for that, we have James Rodriguez, a senior real estate reporter, Business Insider, hopping on the line with us. James, welcome to WGN. Thanks for hopping on.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Can you just explain what the Zestimate is for people that don't know?
So the Zestimate is really foundational to Zillow. I mean, when Zillow debuted in 2006, it was actually really the only thing on Zillow's site. There wasn't a search portal to tell you which homes were for sale or to find an agent. It was just the Zestimate, which is supposed to be this free, unbiased valuation based on a proprietary algorithm for almost every home in the country. So you can look and you can see what your house is worth. You can see what your neighbor's homes are worth, or your coworkers, or your friends, or your exes. And it really, you know, in the years since, has given people this power to look at home values in a way that they hadn't in the past. And with that, I think there have been a lot of questions around the accuracy of the Zestimate. And that's where we get into some of the controversy and the love-hate relationship that agents have with it, and the obsession around the Zestimate that there is today.
Well, there's no joke about it. I've chatted with agents who hate the Zestimate. And let's talk about maybe why they do. What's so wrong about seeing a number on an app that tells me what it obviously is, a computer-generated or some sort of AI-generated number, as like a starting point for maybe what my house may or may not be worth? Is the problem that people don't think of it as a starting point? They think of it as a finishing point?
I think in some cases, yeah. And I think for this, it's important to think, too, about how the Zestimate is calculated. So it's this proprietary algorithm. We don't know exactly how the calculations all work, but it basically takes thousands of data points from public records, you think tax documents or the multiple listing service where most homes are advertised for sale. And it'll take this data on square footage and, you know, how many bathrooms your home has. But it can also, they're working on things now where it can take, you can use AI to basically analyze photos and incorporate some of the information that homeowners submit to the company as well about their home. So it takes all these data points and then spits out this number. And again, the company will say that it's the starting point, but it also touts the numbers generally quite accurate and, you know, a really useful valuation point for a home. And I think, you know, when you look at the data itself, there are a lot of cases in which the Zestimate can be pretty far off from where the home actually would end up selling for. And a lot of times when you look at the accuracy for homes that are on the market, the Zestimate is really leaning heavily on the list price that the seller provides, which, you know, is based on a lot of expertise and consulting with agents. And that, you know, that human factor is actually pretty important for the Zestimate to lean on there.
Right.
So I think, you know, the issue is when people get attached to what can in some cases be an unrealistic number.
Right. And I, you know, I'm not looking at my Zestimate right now because I can't seem to get on Zillow on this computer, but I can get on Redfin. I can see my Redfin mm-hmm. estimate. I know the numbers mm-hmm. are often off and I kind of just like pick right between the middle, but we just redid our basement. That's not included in there, right? Like we took a half unfinished basement and made it a lot more better finished. So, okay, that's not in there. I know that goes into the equation, but I have kind of a deep question for you, James, is that if the buyers, potential buyers, see the Zestimate and they know what it is and they factor that into what they're looking at through prices, and the sellers see the Zestimate as where they're going to list the house at around there, and they're going to not listen to the agent who's saying to do it for less. I guess what I'm asking is, are these algorithms actually becoming the market? Instead of reflecting what the market is, can Zestimates and other valuations actually change the market? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, you know, one of the things that you pointed out in asking that too is there are a lot of different automated valuation models out there that are all going to tell you something different, right? So you can look at the Zestimate, it's going to tell you one thing, and Redfin is going to have its own estimate, and Realtor.com will actually show you three different estimates. And just looking at that, you know, you can see the difference between those three different automated valuation models. So I think there is a lot of variance out there that kind of, I mean, of course, the Zestimate is the kind of the best known and the one that has the most swagger, I guess, in this market. But when you still look at the number of people who are using agents and using that, you know, on the ground expertise, someone who knows the market and knows the nuances of the home, I think that is kind of a safeguard here that prevents, you know, people from completely relying on these numbers, which, you know, in some cases can be very accurate if you're in an area where there are lots of home selling and they have, Zillow has a lot of data to play with there, but where it's in an area where not a lot of homes have sold, it could be pretty far off. And so I think that's the concern here is, you know, just making sure that people use the right amount of caution when looking at these numbers. And keep in mind that oftentimes it's kind of just more of an amusement rather than, you know, a serious pricing tool here.
I think that number of when you say, oh, when a house is far off from what it's worth, that's kind of the crux of my question, though. Like, it's like, if I'm a seller and it's telling me it's this cost or this is what the Zestimate is, and my agent says, no, you can sell it for more. Let's list it for $50,000 more than that because you've done X, Y, or Z. The potential buyers are going to see that estimate, right? They're going to see that Zestimate. And I feel like that can almost make it harder to sell that house for more because now you've got to tell them a story. And maybe some people will buy what you're selling, but other people won't. So, in fact, that Zestimate, from the buying perspective, if the Zestimate is less than what the seller's listing it for, that's going to move their ability to sell it unless you got some magician agent.
I mean, that can definitely be one of the roadblocks. And as I mentioned in my story, there actually have been some cases in which sellers have sued Zillow saying that the Zestimate was this significant impediment that prevented them from selling their house at what they thought it was worth. And, you know, again, there's a lot of different, you know, factors here in terms of, you know, the agent might be saying one thing, an automated valuation model. I think it's important to keep in mind, too, that the free models that are available to consumers are a lot less powerful than some of the business-to-business models that, you know, your average consumer will never get to touch for free, but that banks and lenders and, you know, you think of Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, they use these really powerful models because they have all of this extra data that, you know, even a Zillow might not have. And so there are more powerful AVMs out there that maybe, you know, someday in the future more people will be able to see. But for now, these are kind of, it's really a marketing tool to get people to go to Zillow.com to look at their Zestimate. And then they think, oh, maybe I want to sell or maybe I want to buy and maybe I want to get an agent and use Zillow's mortgage services as well. So it's all part of this, you know, bundle that really, at the end of the day, is meant to draw people to Zillow.com.
You answered my next question, which was going to be, what does the bank use? And if they use a different software and they're going to lend the way they're going to lend, then yeah, I guess that's a protection on the market. You could say you're going to buy this house for X amount, but if the bank thinks, no, according to our algorithm or our, you know, assessment of this thing, that it is way off, that is going to maybe stop a sale from going through. And the lawsuits, that's fascinating too, right? It is this public information that's out there that could potentially move how much you're able to make money off of. And boy, that's fascinating. James, every time you come on WGN, whether it's this show or when I get to have you on Your Money Matters, you get me thinking. Great article, my friend.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and I'll have to have you on Let's Get Legal again sometime to talk a little bit about lawsuits against Zillow. Take care, okay?
Let's do it. Take care. You
for
too.
Sure. That's James Rodriguez, senior real estate reporter at Business Insider, businessinsider.com. I've got my stopwatch ready. Here's Steve Rzanich with the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based Vivid Seats, the online ticketing marketplace, is exploring a sale. Bloomberg reports the company's working with an advisor to gauge interest from buyers. So far, there's been interest from private equity firms. Vivid Seats went public in 2021 and began exploring a sale after takeover interest. Its share price climbed after the news broke. It had fallen 40% in the past year. The company has a market value of about $904 million. Its chief competitors are StubHub and SeatGeek. A shareholder has called for the resignation of the Archer Daniels Midland CEO, claiming there's been a lack of transparency about the Chicago-based company's accounting practices. The news comes a year after ADM disclosed an investigation into the accounting practices at its nutrition unit. The shareholder, Hartwood Fuchs, says CEO Juan Luciano should step down if he can't explain what happened and restore investor trust. He says Luciano didn't do enough to reverse the share loss that happened after the accounting probe disclosure. I'm Steve Brzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And the business of food, here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. Happy New Year. And if one of your resolutions is to eat less beef, this guy wants to help.
We created the first and only 50-50 burger. It is half meat and half veggie.
More from him after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. On the phone is
Andrew Arentowitz, CEO and co-founder of 50-50 Foods.
Andrew says a lot of us are rethinking the amount of beef we eat, whether for health reasons or environmental reasons, and the highly touted alternatives like Beyond Meat have largely failed.
We believe it is an impossible goal to get everybody to turn into a vegetarian, so we decided to meet in the middle and give people exactly what they say they want. Meat, but less meat.
He says the frozen patties are made with high-quality Angus beef.
That is mixed with roasted mushrooms, caramelized onions, cauliflower, broccoli, roasted garlic, and a little bit of seasoning. Zero binders, zero additives, nothing you can't pronounce. Everything that you'd find in your own kitchen.
You know, Andrew, this sounds pretty simple.
It's harder than you think to have it not fall apart. So if you were to try this in your kitchen, chances are your burger would fall apart. So we've got a pending process patent for how to do this without having to add any additives or binders.
Okay, well, how's it taste? That's been the downfall of the plant-based imitators.
Most people can't really tell the difference. I mean, there's a slight mouthfeel difference. There's a slight taste difference, but it's more kind of a savory, you know, vegetables make meat taste better.
Okay, what about price?
We're trying to either match or beat the beef that we are competing with.
And what's been the response?
People love it. This is about health. This is about taste. This is about understanding that asking Americans to give up meat is a challenge. And we're trying to celebrate all of these things by creating just one delicious burger that basically anyone can enjoy.
You can't walk into the Jewel and buy the 50-50 burger, but
I love Chicago, and I would love to be a part of any regional retailers in that area.
For now, let your fingers do the shopping.
Anyone in the country can get this at Thrive Market. If you go to thrivemarket.com, they ship anywhere in the nation.
All right, good luck. On the food calendar, it's National Buffet Day and National Cream Puff Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I've been to the boat show many times over the years. Used to be just a couple steps from water along Lake Michigan. Moving this year to Rosemont. Here to chat about that and what we can expect, Darren Enval, Vice President of Midwest Boat and Sports Shows for the National Marine Manufacturers Association. Thanks for joining us, Darren.
Oh, no, thank you, John, for having me on the air to talk about the Chicago Boat Show.
I guess the Des Plaines River is close by. Why the move to Rosemont?
We did a careful analysis with our exhibitors, all the shareholders, and the decision, a difficult decision, was to move to Rosemont to align with the show. So we're excited about the new home. We're going to miss McCormick Place, but most importantly, we're excited about the new home at the Donald B. Stevens in Rosemont. With that entertainment district, the parking, everything should be really, really good for attendees to be able to enjoy the Chicago show.
I mean, this is a staple show in the Midwest when it comes to boat shows.
It is. And nothing has changed. Actually, this year we are up on the square footage sold as well as the number of boats that will be on display. So people should anticipate seeing everything that they saw at the Chicago Boat Show and more.
What are the specs? Give us a little bit, because if you've never been to the boat show, this can be an aspirational trip, meaning, oh my gosh, if only I was a billionaire. But it can also be a very practical trip, too, for boating enthusiasts.
It is, John. I mean, it has something for everybody. So my recommendation is for people to visit chicagoboatshow.com. There are a lot of activities as well as the boats on display. So what you'll find on display is everything related to getting on the water, you know, starting with the stand-up paddle boards and kayaks to aluminum and fiberglass fishing boats, pontoons, runabout, wake boats, personal watercraft, cruisers. So everything will be on there. And if you have your boat, we also have electronics and gear for people to see the latest and greatest.
Do you have kayaks and canoes too, that sort of stuff?
We do, yeah, and including the latest trend is the stand-up paddleboard. So we will have hard kayaks as well as the inflatable kayaks and stand-up paddleboards. We actually even do have a pool in the feature area. It's called Paddle Fest, where people would be able to test out on the water stand-up paddleboards and kayaks.
Yeah, I did that live on a morning show. It did not go well.
Oh, no.
I'm a little top-heavy, I think, for a stand-up paddleboard. My mom does it really well, and when we're up in Wisconsin, boy, I'm so impressed with the people that do it. But yeah, better give it a chance in a small pool, or make sure you got your life vest on if you're trying it for the first time in the open water.
It is. It is. And actually, this year we're having our first annual bags tournament to win a prize package by Paddle North. So visit Chicago Boat Show, get information on participating in the bags tournament on Saturday to win a prize package.
Are these only like boats on display that are for power, or do we talk fishing boats here too?
We have fishing boats on display, power boats, you know, runabouts, wake boats, pontoons. So everything that you can imagine to get in on the water.
Fun for the whole family. I imagine you guys are posting that everywhere you can.
Yeah, so we have a kids zone. So kids, would be able to do the stand-up paddleboard, as we talked about. There's a bumper boat. There's the Huckfin Trout Pond. Everybody remembers getting their first trout at the Chicago Boat Show. We also have a Discover Boating Beach Club. It's a great way to engage with the community and try different activities within it. So we do have Bon Appetit is the prime goal this year, which is you're able to see gourmet Chicago food at the Discover Boating Beach Club.
How much are the tickets to get in the door?
On site, it's $15, but you can buy the tickets at the Chicago Boat Show website for a $2 discount, so $13.
Do you guys have the big yacht still, the big things that I'm never going to be able to afford, but I still want to walk through and see it?
We will. You know, the biggest boat this year, I think we have is a 45-foot boat, so we're really excited to have that come in and for people to see at the show.
What else do people need to know?
Parking is right there. You know, again, visit chicagoboatshow.com. It's very convenient to park, walk across the, you know, Sky Bridge to get to the convention center. The website will list all the different activities on site, the interactive floor plan, so you can plan your visit. There's information on Boat Finder. You know, you can see all the boats that will be on display before you get on site. And what's wonderful about that Rosemont Entertainment District, after you get done enjoying the boat show, you can walk to one of the wonderful restaurants that's connected to the facility.
630 wants to know, you got any sailboats?
Unfortunately, we don't have any sailboats. We continue to engage with the community and would love to have them come back to the show. So we'll continue to work on that. It's something that he's right. It's a full circle for getting on the water. But unfortunately, there will be no sailboats on display.
Okay, but plenty others. And again, chicagoboatshow.com. Darren, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yep, thank you, John.
That's Darren.
Look forward to seeing you at the show.
For sure. Darren Enval, Vice President of Midwest Boat and Sports Shows. And yes, live on TV. I did a lot of goofy things on TV. The boat show was always one of them. I mean, it's fun. The yachts are insane. I mean, good on you if you get to buy a little. Maybe yacht's not even the word. I know that Bob Kessler has a yacht of his own, but I think it'd be more of the sailboat variety.
The pocket yacht.
The pocket yacht.
17 right. Whole feet.
That's right. But some of these, oh my gosh, they're living large there. I see them out on the, what's it called out there? The playpen? Tie up,
yes,
against
that is
each
the
other.
Pen.
That's a life I didn't lead, Bob Kessler.
Yeah, I've yet to do the playpen. I don't know if I want to.
Me and you, let's do a playpen day.
Right, just a mini playpen. Well, you're gonna have a real playpen in your life pretty soon.
Oh, that's a whole other story.
Pack and play, all that.
And that'll be the end of my playpen days.